radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Time and space is a place that only a human being locates, where there's so much information to take. There you enter an entirely new place. Once you get off the internet, become World Wide Web.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. I'm your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanley, inviting you to stay tuned for interesting interviews, news you can use, and programming designed with you in mind. Free your mind, the rest will follow, right here on the Cyberspace Sanctuary, on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.
Cyberspace is the place. Cyberspace is the place.
We'll be right back. my name is Renoka Rashidi. I'm an avid fan of and a big supporter of Brother Junior Stanton.
Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind, on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. My name is Junius Ricardo Stanton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us, and we thank you for logging on. And we encourage you to download the Rainbow Soul app for your smartphone. We'll be coming up very shortly with the ability to download it for those of you who have iPhones. So we are moving into the era of mobility and connectivity, so you can carry us with you on your personal devices, such as your notebooks, your laptops, and your phones. So this is major, major progress, and we anticipate many more listeners and the ability to impact our listeners on a wider, more frequent basis. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with our guest, Emory Graham, a writer, photojournalist, and intellectual, and we'll speak with him on a myriad of topics following these messages. Don't go anywhere. You're logged on to Rainbow Soul on the Blake Radio Network. The name of this program is The Cyberspace Sanctuary.
Greetings to the Internet Radio family. This is Reverend Valentine speaking. You know, for nearly 30 years, I have had the distinct experience of being interviewed over every medium of communication available to the public. And except for the metaphysical underground, I can think of no other electronic venue that has been more progressive, more innovative, more insightful, more diligent, more diverse in its demographics, and more courageously supportive of the truth than this ever-growing phenomenon called Internet radio. And this is precisely why I'm here to tell you that it is so vital that you give your wholehearted support to it. Tell a friend. In fact, tell 2, 3, and 4 of your friends. If you are a business owner, support Internet radio by telling your customers and constituents all about it. Let them know that there is a legitimate and important substitute to all of the prefabricated, super-censored garbage polluting our public airways today. Don't allow the mass media to continue to treat you like a mindless consumer drone. Enhance your awareness. Indulge your critical thinking, your reasoning, and your analysis. Do as I do. Log on, listen in, and then let it be known all about your internet radio experience. Chimatep, beloved family, thank you for listening. Walk in light.
Hi, I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, inviting you to join me in financially supporting the Blake Radio Network on a regular basis. We need your continuing patronage to help the Blake Radio Network remain alive and thriving both now and well into the future. There are several easy ways you can send your contribution. To use PayPal, click on the help link on the Blake Radio Network's website at www.blakeradio.com, or you can go directly to the PayPal website and click the send money link. Type in rainbowsoul@blakeradio.com as the email address and Unlimited Ventures as the payee. Then follow the instructions. To send a check or money order, make it out to Unlimited Ventures, care of Neil Blake, and mail it to 73 Ireland Place, that's Ireland Place, Suite 109, Amityville, Amityville, New York, 11701. It's easy, painless, and uncomplicated. And you'll feel great after doing it, knowing you're keeping the Blake Radio Network alive and on the cutting edge of media technology. I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, thanking you in advance for your support.
Racist Professor Griffin, you're listening to Junius Ricardo Stanton. Straight up, we're teaching you all those things you need to know from the neck up, all right? We're definitely doing a checkup from the neck up. This is Professor Griffin, Public Enemy, the ex-minister. I'm out. Peace.
I neglected to inform you that we started off the program with a message in the music, Desiree, Strengthen Your Mind. And that's what we encourage here on Rainbow Soul by offering a dynamic list of hosts, programs, a myriad of topics, interests to strengthen your mind, to strengthen your resolve, to help you cope and navigate this journey we call life. Today we have the opportunity to dialogue with Emory Graham, who's a writer, a photojournalist, and a person I consider an intellectual. And we used to write for the same paper, the Black Suburban Journal, before it went defunct, went out of business. And so it's a pleasure to have him on our program today. We're sure that you will enjoy the conversation. Our guest on today's program is writer, intellectual, and now a photojournalist, Emory Graham. We had the pleasure of contributing to a newspaper together, the Black Suburban Journal, and I always enjoy our conversations because he gives me something to think about, and I'm sure that once he starts talking and sharing his experiences, you'll feel the same way. Welcome, brother. How are you today?
I'm very good, Junius. Glad to be on the program with you once again.
You know, a couple of years ago, I had you when we were doing a program, and I got not a lot, but several responses. They were impressed by the dialogue, the depth of the conversation, and what we were talking about. So that's a good thing in today, where you have a lot of mind-numbing claptrap and just nonsense that's permeating the waves and dumbing people down.
I agree. This information density, I think, part of the really strange or standout portion of this period of history, and certainly in my life, is the amount of information that's available that people can be exposed to because of this new technology. Everybody's got a cell phone. Everybody doesn't have a computer, but more and more people are getting them. And these social media websites, the information, if you have the cell phone, if you have the computer or the iPad, is just huge. It's phenomenal.
Well, it's a two-edged sword because for quite some time now, even before 9/11, as you well know, the government in conjunction and collusion with the telecommunications companies were illegally spying on U.S. citizens, and they retrofitted immunity because they broke the law under the Bush administration. So they have now amped it up to the point that Big Brother, the real Big Brother that we're experiencing, goes beyond the Big Brother of George Orwell.
Sure. Well, if you just kind of sit back and take, I guess, maybe a skeptical look, where the real challenge is, there seems to be sets of laws in place that protect the rights of the individual. And, you know, our high school background informs us about the Bill of Rights in the Constitution. But yet, at the same time, most of the folks in the Problems of Democracy class who read the book and read the Constitution and know something about the history were always in debates in that classroom about the three-fifths compromise and the breaking of the rules that are actually laid out in the rule book, so that when you reflect on it, what life has been in this country has really been a practice of turning a blind eye to the contradictions that exist in the founding documents and the ideology about America. It's been that way since its founding. I mean, the Native Americans can tell you a story. The African Americans can tell you a story. And there are a lot of Europeans who got their butts whooped who won't tell the story about their butt whooping. So we've kind of lived in a world all our lives where it's been with contradiction to the established law. So now we're here. And this information flood constantly brings that back to our face over and over. And as you point out, the powers that be are violating our privacy rights we thought we had, which we never had.
Yeah, and that's becoming, I think, untenable to more and more Euro-Americans. It seems like the impact and the effect and the affect of COINTELPRO on us has pretty much cooled us out in terms of any kind of revolutionary or reformist or even self-determinist fervor, you know, based on what we went through from the civil rights movement to the Black Power movement, and then what happened with the government, their counterinsurgency program that wasn't just directed at Black people, but
That's right.
primarily at us, because they view us as the most potential fifth column here, because they pretty much decimated the Native Americans, and the ones that they haven't totally decimated, they bought them off with these casino situations. So now, because we had a conversation about a week or so ago, you and I, about what was going on, and basically the Euro-Americans are waking up to the fact that the American dream has been snatched out from under them, and the butt whippings that you refer to, that, you know, the disaffected whites that didn't own property, that weren't included in the Constitution, who couldn't vote, who couldn't hold office and all of that, they're more and more increasingly putting these present-day Euro-Americans back to that status. The only thing is they'll let them vote to think that they have some skin in the game when they really don't.
Well, I think you hit it, and I went kind of in two directions on the commentary you just made. The first direction was the question of whether you're going to ask permission to do anything under the laws of the land. African Americans, I think, they got pushed to the point that they just said, you know, you got to get me because you're going to get up off of me one way or the other. And what frightened or challenged the system was that people were willing to die about it. They would get on buses, go right to the hole, right down in the middle of the dirt, and stand up and say, get up off me. And they got killed. Them crackers jumped up and down. They lynched folks. And you had young white folks get on that bus and go down there and say, you got to get me, but I'm going to do what the law says I can do. So that's kind of a bellwether in this country when you push people to the point where they say, I'd rather die fighting you than die being afraid of you as you continue to beat me. That's always been a hinge point, a tipping point in the conduct of control over the masses in America. That's why right now, if you listen to that news about Trayvon, they're worried. Their whole thing is, if Sharpton and them keep raising hell on television, no matter, there's only one outcome that's going to be acceptable to the people who resonate with their argument, and that is the boy got to go to jail or something. Otherwise, and old Bill O'Reilly said this last night, there's going to be riots in the street. And now he wants to play on, well, justice isn't served. Well, I went by that because justice wasn't served when the boy got killed. So all of these spinoffs is a product of a world you guys set up and defend. Let's stop the dumb stuff. You did it. Live with it. And I think that's where a lot of African Americans really end up. They go on and live their lives. And if it comes to get them, then they know they got a decision to make. And a lot of folks refuse to live in fear. Yeah, I ain't thinking about you. Get out my face. Get up off me. I'm going to make my way in this world. Now, them poor white boys, they bought a package and they know they bought the package. And now that the guys who sold them the package are reneging, and this is not the first time in history that the owners have reneged. You read about Bacon's Rebellion, if you Google that.
Yeah, Shay's Rebellion, too.
And Shay's Rebellion. This is not the first time that the company corporate directors reneged on the indentured servants. So, you know, but it takes some thinking and some reading to get that perspective, Junius. You gotta go a while. You have to think about that for a while.
But that gets back to what you talked about, the information age, and I maintain yes. But they've countered the information that is available by dumping more disinformation and misinformation and spin and propaganda into the mix. So you have to be more critical in terms of what you consume in terms of news, and also be critical in your thinking and your analysis. And for a lot of folks, I'm not seeing it. I mean, like at the event we were at, you and I got reacquainted a week or so ago, we were speaking with an attorney talking about the situation with the fraud and all that. He seems genuinely clueless about what we were talking about. And that's not a put down on a brother. That's just a commentary on just how bamboozled and unaware a lot of folks are.
Well, Genius, I don't know that he was unaware as much as he was secure in the position he held where he lives. And I think that has a lot to do with it, beyond just being factually aware of the contradictions and the systemic violations of the law that is carried on by the power structure, of which he was a part. He's a part of the bar, the legal support system. So I suspect that he's fully aware, and in his position at the back of his career in the, you know, the area where he lives and amongst his clientele, he feels very comfortable and doesn't see this situation in terms of the commitment against this kind of thing happening. I mean, we are involving ourselves with issues that many people are capable of recognizing and intellectually can see the contradictions, but don't feel a vested interest in the outcomes. That kind of signals a split or a term of grouping amongst people who are critical thinkers. There are those who see it in print, see the contradictions, but in their personal lives, they don't feel that they suffer or have any vested interest in the outcome one way or another, except at the very extreme. The other part is that in order to be critical, you got to be a reader. You can't be critical in the sense of comparing and contrasting things, which is how I take the notion of critical. I'm examining, I'm looking, I'm comparing, I'm contrasting, and I'm seeing what seems to fit and go along with the beliefs and the proposed reality, and what doesn't. That's what, to me, is critical thinking. Well, you got, in this information age, you got some work to do, Junior. You got a lot of reading to do. And I think that capacity to read and think and discuss is not equally shared in our population. I like to do it, quite frankly. Other people can and don't like to do it. And I think that self-selection, who's going to be involved, who has found it pleasurable to do those things and think about those problems and issues, at some point you kind of distinguish yourself. You're rare, Junior. You're very rare.
Well, you mentioned something the other day that you were saying that people in that category who are critical thinkers and people who ask questions will distinguish themselves. They'll be cut off from the herd and probably dealt with on some level. You know, because and it's interesting you said that, because that previous week I was called for jury duty, and I was in the panel box watching them as they were picking people, and most of the people wanted to get out of it, so they finally picked some people, and then a couple of, you know, lawyers get their chance to knock folks off. But every one of them, the judge would ask them about any bumper stickers they had, what type of what they watched on television, what type of websites, trying to glean something about the person. It's almost they want people who are caught up in the broad road, that leads to destruction, as Yeshua would say. They don't want the people who ventured off and tried to make their own way, you know, intellectually, psychologically, or even in terms of making their way in the world, navigating the world.
Sure. There's a theme to the information and the communication that the decision makers and controllers in the media, in the corporations and government want the general public, the masses, to believe. And when you think about running a group organization, you've got a line of reasoning and a way of behaving and a way of thinking that you would like to see the masses of people you lead take up, because it makes them easy to control. Well, that's what we end up watching on the TV, and the people who run the institutions and the organizations of our society are tuned into the style of thinking of the masses or the public who end up participating in their organization. They know how they need the people to think to facilitate behavior that serves their purposes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then they question, they query, they pick and choose. And you can easily figure out what they're kind of going toward by listening to the questions they ask and watching what they do when the answers come forth. And that's why you have to, if you're concerned at a certain level, you have to keep reading. You can't stop. And you have to keep talking to a broad audience, so you can begin to see the patterns that emerge. I mean, that's really what this is about. And everything's in your face. There's nothing hidden from you. You just have to have enough energy, curiosity, and will to go find it, read it, understand it, and talk about it. And it does, it'll emerge if you pursue it at that level. It'll come out to you. So, you know, we're going to be faced with that more and more. As we go forward. And you're right. If you're a person who's a critical thinker and you ask questions and you don't accept answers that are contradictory or don't make sense, then the person who's posing these questions to you, they're assessing and measuring you for some reason. Just like anybody else in a dialogue is assessing and measuring the responses they're getting and forming a picture or an image. That's what's going on out here. So we just have to get used to that, ready for it, and decide what we're going to accept and not accept, who we're going to relate to. But that's no different than any other time in the past, I don't think.
Right, right.
You know, and some people choose to be conscious. I mean, it's like going to a horror show, like a movie. Some people are going to look at every gory, bloody sight, everything. Other people are going to hide their eyes sometime. Now, they're going to be sitting in the movie and they done paid for a ticket, got their popcorn. But when they get fear in their heart based on the structure of what they're seeing on the screen and their own internal fears, they'll drop their eyes, or they'll hide their face, or they'll start a conversation. at the point where the their perceived things on the screen scare them. Well, I find that that's kind of an analogy to our friend from New York that we were talking about, the attorney.
Mm-hmm.
That may be another reason that backed his expression or lack of expression about certain things, that they didn't want to be identified as having a point and at some level even being aware of the controversy. Now, that's really deep. When the guy in slavery says, slavery, what's that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's a scared person, Junior. So yeah, we got to be prepared for that at that level. And, of course, we've talked about Alex Jones, a white guy that on one level I admire because he urges his listeners to go look up the documentation that backs what he asserts, what he's saying is going on. That's unique to me. I don't find any radio talk show host that in essence say, don't pay attention to what I just said. Go look it up. Mm-hmm. Don't believe me. Go mm-hmm. look it up. Here's the references. I've never heard that before, Junior, ever, in a talk show host that has slants on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Even now, he's that poor white boy who, in doing that research, has found overwhelming evidence of the breaking of the white skin privilege trust. He now knows that the white boys in power don't think any more of poor white skin people than they do of poor black skinned people or the dog or the cat out there in the yard. And to hear him, he is going ballistically crazy on internet radio, Julius. It's almost pitiful. Can you imagine how those poor white people feel now, who have been raised under that illusion? And here comes all this information, incontrovertible evidence in writing, that the white boys in power have been dogging poor white people worse than they dogged the slaves. At least the slaves got to eat. And, you know, they didn't have no political power, but they were investments, and them white boys protected their investments. They spit on. They despise crackers and clay eaters and wool hats and Okies. Those are names that white people gave other poor white people.
Mm-hmm.
Black
yep.
folks didn't make that up, Junior.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, now that is also coming to the fore in this time period, and the curse of all curses, the straw that broke the camel's back, was a black man became president of the United States of America. Holy smoke. That ended white skin privilege. That's it.
Yeah.
There ain't no more.
Yeah. And so, they also put to rest a lot of the stuff that they said about the capabilities of African people.
That's right.
So that unnerves them even more.
It's over.
Yeah.
Now, the fact that them poor white boys is buying guns at record rates indicates a burgeoning or unfolding reaction at some level, Juniors. And I do believe that the next big fight won't have anything to do with African Americans. Some are saying that all this stuff on TV about Trayvon Martin is an effort to put black folks back in front of them angry white boys and misdirect them with regard to who is actually hurting them. That's part of the Willie Lynch divide and conquer strategy. But yet you have guys like Alex Jones on the radio coming to the conclusion that's what's going on. That it's really not about a white guy, whoever, kills a black guy unjustly, that's for the slow thinkers. That the real angle and the way that the media is playing this out with cooperation with the courts and the justice system is just creating a kerfuffle, a crazy situation because it seems so straightforward, but yet justice hasn't been carried out. Not even the normal procedures. Joke ain't been in jail no time. So that's got people looking at the racial hookup, when in fact, that ain't what it's about at all at a different level. It's about capturing the anger and the frustration of poor white people and directing it toward black people versus the people who's kicking the poor white guy's butt, Wall Street and the thieves, the money thieves. That's who is trying to hide behind this particular construction of conflict. But it takes some thinking to be able to see this situation in that manner. So for people who think they can see it that way and draw a picture of an alternative like that, all you can do is sit back and wait and watch how this thing unfolds and to see what's ultimately going to end up happening. I get my signals because I've never listened to white talk show hosts, especially on the radio when they rant and rave and sound like Rush Limbaugh. Yeah, I'm cutting that out. But when I found this joker, Alex Jones, and listened to the things he was representing, he was struggling with, and the way he rolls, the way he plays, I'm using him like a thermometer or a barometer, a weather vane, because he represents a faction of that white power structure on the bottom.
Yeah.
And when he starts pulling it apart and coming to a conclusion that it's a throw off from the main show, from the real game, from where the real harm is emerging, then I'm saying, okay, he's talking to 3, 4, 5 million people. And definitely most of them are not African American or Hispanic. So now we're going to see how this shakes out, Junior.
Well, a couple of days ago, about a week or so ago, we had Dick Gregory on.
Yeah, I heard that.
There was a little tension in that conversation, but you know, he sees it for what it is. I'm not saying he has some, because it takes an exceptional European to step beyond that.
That's right.
White supremacy mindset.
That's right.
And I'm not saying that Alex Jones is there, but he does see how various groups are being played against each other.
Well, it's difficult as I sit here and hear the thing you just spotted, the difficulty for Europeans to step past that superiority game. I agree. And I don't know of many contemporary Europeans that have stepped past it like a joker like John Brown.
Right, right.
Or Thomas Garrett. See, I don't, and they wouldn't get a big play in contemporary America. You wouldn't find them posted up on Fox News.
Oh, no. Mm-mm.
They'd hide them like 60 going north. Well, so the question is, for me, I'm measuring the pressure in the system by the leadership that's called forth from the pressure. The times and the struggles that people face, I think, generate the social relations that yield leadership. So when groups go under heavy pressure and there's a clear group identification in front of you, it's out of that pressure and the social relations and the challenges where leadership emerges. And somebody steps up and forgets about the threat or potential harm that can come to an individual for expressing opposition to the conditions and the people and the system that is bringing the pain to their group.
But that's that, when the state or the king or the local fiefdom or the honcho puts up the pressure, because you talked about the other rebellion, Shays Rebellion, and some of the other rebellions, the right after World War One, when the,
yep,
the soldiers went down to D.C., they unleashed, and if you study the labor movement in this country, you really see it.
Yeah.
Where they unleashed all kinds of violence and viciousness against the people. I mean, just take a look at the Occupy movement, where they send out Gestapos. That's what I'm calling these SWAT teams, these riot-clad police, to bust up these camps. These are basically college kids or young people, for the most part, talking about, trying to raise consciousness about what's going on. And the state, in a coordinated effort, on one time, it was 18 cities. They all did it at 1 o'clock in the morning. So it was a concerted effort. So just like on the plantation where they would brutalize somebody, remember Roots, where he beat Kunta Kinte until he succumbed to the point he recognized his name as Toby. And they had people watching it. And that's to instill fear in the rest of the people, in the rest of the herd.
You remember the Chicago Convention riots, Democratic Convention. You remember Kent State, where the National Guard killed up a ton of white folks. This clash between the white factions within our system is not unprecedented and new. And it's generally in our time period been the younger kids who have spent the blood fighting the contradiction between their beliefs and how they see their parents and grandparents exercising power contrary to the beliefs they were raised in. This is the pressure that I'm talking about. And remember, for the most part, those kids weren't poor white kids. They were children of the middle and upper class. And the kids at the Chicago Convention wasn't poor white folks. And God knows at Kent State, poor people wasn't going to college.
Right, right.
So here we have a generational battle within the white power structure. And the people on the bottom of that power structure and their children are the ones to end up fighting against the minions of the real money. That's how this thing tends to play out. So as we talk and discuss this thing, we're basically posing a challenge to the listeners of this radio show, because there's nothing personal between you and I in terms of our own character that anybody with a computer and can read and write and think they can get in this just like we are. And that is what the system is not designed to consciously generate. That when you put the information out like this, and that's why they're threatening about locking down the internet.
Right, right.
You can't dictate where a person ends up in their thought process.
Well, what you see is, and the real reason they are consolidating a lot of these social networking platforms is because they're being used to monitor people's whereabouts, where they go, what they think. That's what Twitter is about. Facebook is really a monitoring, showing how you link up with who are your associates, who are your like-minded people.
Yeah.
What's your walls and all that kind of. That's why I'm not into it really, because it allows them to see what's going on, and it's not being paranoid. people really need to understand that, like I said in the beginning of the program, the Big Brother that we're experiencing is far more entrenched and codified than the Big Brother that George Orwell wrote about in 1984. I just want to swing back because you were a writer. We both wrote for the Black Suburban Journal back in the 90s. And then you've segued and reinvented yourself as a photojournalist. So how is that different from, you know, writing an opinion column or writing stories?
Well, actually, what you're doing is adding another dimension of communication to the one you already had. If you think about the impact that visual images have on your thought process and how television is primarily a visual communication medium. Whereas writing and just the audio portion of communication is a verbal, non-visual beyond writing, of course, you have to decipher symbols, and audio, you're deciphering sound. I'm just adding another dimension through which I can communicate, hopefully, my meaning to people who I communicate with. And so when I caught on to the role of communication in social control, I went out and did a master's degree in what's called development communication at the University of the Philippines in their online school. And it helped me form up in a systematic way what I had come to conclude had occurred as a result of all that writing we were doing for the Black Suburban Journal and Sonny Driver. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Scoop USA. Yeah.
Scoop USA. That's what I couldn't think of at the event. And what happened that convinced me about the power of the visual thing was I was the Brownfields coordinator in Wilmington, Delaware, and because I was a one-man band and because of the structure of the system at the time, I was reaching out to the community heavily and conveying to them what I was going through and how it impacted their lives. And part of what I did was use maps and pictures to illustrate to people the words that I was using. And it came out, the outcomes were such that one person could pretty much stand off and inform people of things that the system didn't particularly want them to know. So in any event, I went ahead and did the formal training, and I'd been shooting since 78 with photography. Can't draw worth a lick, can't get a straight line out, and that at one level was my only artistic bent. So I had those two things come together in my life, and when I finally retired, I knew that I really loved the practice of photography and I loved to write and communicate. So I decided, rather than retiring and going back into some institution or organization, that I would develop my photography practice and put together, some products and also keep growing in the practice of photography and international travel and development communication and fighting oppression, just as simple as that. I guess it ain't so simple.
Yeah, because you really can't grow rich doing that. I mean, I used to write, and then I was an editor for this paper, The Real News in Philly, and I used to tell the owner and the publisher, I said, look, man, you know, because he was into socialism, I was into nationalism. I said, man, you know, it's going to be hard to get ads, and we scuffled by, and then he put out another paper called The Black business, and we got a little bit more, but I think a lot of times they paid him back for the radical stuff by not advertising in the in the thing. So I know if you're going out and documenting the struggle, and you've been a couple of places around the world doing photo essays and photo journalism, there's not a large market for that kind of stuff, is there?
Well, the market is emerging, and I say that from kind of a technical sense of business marketing and cash flow and sales. When I went to Santo Domingo, I was invited there to do a shoot for the Dominican Republic Sports and Education Association, which is a nonprofit that's promoting high school education leading to college for kids in Santo Domingo who are also good at baseball and end up getting recruited to the Major League Baseball camps. Every Major League team has a training camp in Santo Domingo. And evidently they see that the talent pool there is huge, and they've invested in recruiting kids at about 16 years old to come to these camps and see if they can make a farm team. And every year, you know, last year I think one 16-year-old kid got a contract with $3.5 million. And I asked my friend, Charles Burrell, I said, what the heck can a 16-year-old kid do on a baseball field worth $3.5 million? And he very clearly said, throw a 100-mile-an-hour fastball every time he pitches. So I said, okay, I got it. But when you go and see the lifestyle, it's the classic American kid comes out of a poor family, a poor rural family, living in the Appalachian Mountains or down in the Delta of Mississippi, and lucks out, somebody sees them playing ball and takes them to a camp, and you know, they're the Horatio Alger story from rags to riches. Well, that is a way of life in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic. So what Charles sees is that these kids end up getting used and discarded, whereas they have some value, they are intelligent, and if they got their GED or high school diploma and took the SATs because of their high baseball skills, they could get picked up by any NCAA school in the country and get a scholarship and go on to college. So part of what I did was to facilitate his working with the Major League Baseball office down there and the director of Dominican Baseball for Major League Baseball, Rafael Perez. And Charles does programs that link the baseball executives to the communities where they draw the kids from. So I shot a reading program that DRSEA runs where he brings in baseball executives from the Dominican operations into the communities and engages them with the kids and their families. So I took pictures of that engagement, one such engagement, and learned how that system was working. So the pictures ended up in an online publication called Dominican Today, and also a newsletter that DRSEA publishes to about 6,000 readers. And that's an example of using the photography to tell the story, to promote a more equitable world, and you've got Major League Baseball, which is huge economics, involved in it, so much so that Major League Baseball has made a commitment to back education for their Dominican people because of three things that was threatening the credibility of Major League Baseball, and you've seen it recently in the news. One, the kids from the Dominican may not tell the correct age in order to get more money when they sign. They may not give the correct name, part of not telling the correct age, in order to meet the highest standards when they sign. And lastly is drugs, steroid use. And Major League Baseball's taken some black eyes about that. And recently you had a couple of guys on, I think, the Dodgers, and I forgot the other team, where the Dominican guys were discovered to have used false names and false ages, and they were pulled from the active roster. So Major League Baseball finds that that takes away from the credibility of the game, casts some very negative aspersions on the game, and they realize that they have to reach further into the lives of the third world players they bring in because the systems aren't around them that protect Major League Baseball in the Western world, the United States, Japan, wherever they're pulling these guys from. They're systems that protect the integrity of their decisions. In the States, you got birth certificates that for the most part work. You've got kids' high school records, so you know who they are all the way through school. It's easy access. And, of course, the drug issue is the drug issue, and that's caught up in another system. But you have early and cheap testing. And the high schools, the feeder systems, don't, as a rule, they don't accept kids taking steroids to boost up their musculature to increase their competitiveness. That's not the case in Venezuela, the Dominican Republic, Mexico, even Puerto Rico, where you get a high percentage of your foreign and Latin American ball players. That's where they come from. So this development photography, which is something I got to trademark soon, I've looked it up and nobody else is using the term, goes to how do you use photography to promote community and economic development? That's the question that development photography addresses. So I think I want to spend my retirement years building that practice.
Now, haven't you gone to other places looking into this microeconomic situation? And I forgot, you told me with the country, I forgot where you went.
Went to India.
Yeah, so tell what was that about and how'd you get there?
Well, part of my academic background has been with the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy at the University of Delaware, where I was a PhD candidate. And the gentleman who runs the center is a former classmate, Dr. John Byrne, JB to his friends. And so he, when he graduated from the doctorate program, he started an Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy at the University of Delaware, first in the nation, and over 30 years built the program to internationally recognized organization. Well, a lot of his students over the years came from India. And so when you go to India and talk about energy and environmental policy, 9 times out of 10, you're going to be talking to a graduate from the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy. So Dr. Byrne takes his current students. He'll take a crew over during the January session at the university, and 1 year I got invited to go, me and my partner, Linda. And we toured 4 cities in India and looked at the energy and environmental policy regimes and activities going on in those places, Chennai, Pune, Pondicherry, and Mumbai. And in each place, there were a number of UD graduates from that center's program who hosted us and took us into their organization to look at what they were doing to advance the principles of equity and fairness in the energy and environmental regime in India. So I got to do a lot of shooting there, met a lot of people I'd been in class with who had since moved on, and looked at how they were addressing the challenges of what boils down to those in power using what's known as the commons, the natural environment, and taking it and putting it into privately controlled production systems so that the water that's naturally here, the air that's naturally here, the soil that's naturally here, is an inheritance of man generally, generic man. But yet these private organizations take that inheritance and use it in their money-making process. And because that process uses what's known as industrial power, or power supplied by machines, it does the production activity night and day, day and night, relentlessly. And when you think that when a product is produced, just generally, all the materials aren't used. There's some waste that occurs. And the waste is defined by the fact that whoever's making it doesn't have a market for that material that's left over after they get done making whatever they're going to sell. But the fact is they have to do something with it. And the fact is because you're using machines to make it, it just keeps piling up and piling up and piling up. And you're taking off the piece you're going to take to the market, but what do you do with the piece that you have no use for? In the chemical industry, what they did was put it in tank trucks and then go into poor communities or rural areas and dump it in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Or when you have power companies who generate electric, the saleable product, the non-saleable portion goes up the smokestack and is what we call smog and air pollution. And it hangs over our cities. Delaware, the Wilmington area, is so polluted in the air that the transportation department threatened to cut their money off because they weren't running programs logically designed to reduce the air pollution. So there's air, water pollution. There's so many pharmaceutical and chemical waste in the water that comes down the Delaware River, where an awful lot of people and cities get their drinking water, that the darn pharmaceuticals are showing up in your drinking water in quantities that affect your biology. So there we go again. So in third world countries where they are just now moving into increased industrialization and manufacturing, because remember, the third world traditionally was used for raw materials. The Europeans didn't want them to start manufacturing finished products. What the Europeans wanted was to take the raw materials, ship it to Europe,
right,
turn it into finished products, and then go back and sell it back to them.
Yeah, well, that's their model that they use in Africa, too, you know.
That in India, before Gandhi and throughout early history, the Indians were so advanced in their material agricultural era that when the European traders came, the kings who met them said, "What do I want with this garbage? Here, take this back," and gave them the most refined cloth, silks, and all kinds of peppers and condiments, and said, "Here, take this as a gift and get out of here with that junk you got." When the British came, one of the first things they did was told the people, "You can't weave cloth no more. You can't go to the ocean and generate salt. You got to buy it from Britain." That's part of what got the fight started. And they destroyed the Indian textile industry. Ain't that something?
Well,
until you read critically, you really don't understand what the strategy was of colonialism and imperialism that Europe was running on everybody.
Yeah, I was just about to say they've done this. If you look at Haiti,
yep,
what they've done to the rice economy, that segment of the economy is the exact same thing as you just said that they did in India. I mean,
yeah,
and it's you know, it's the same game they play over and over again, and it works because they have the armaments and the viciousness in their mindset they'll broke no resistance.
Yeah,
And classic example, the reason I'm bringing Haiti up is because Haiti resisted and beat them, and so now they're marked for eternity. I mean, they're going to attempt to grind those Africans down until there's nothing left. I mean, they're going to squeeze and extract everything they have, especially now that they found oil off the coast. So, I mean,
Cuba's in the same position. And I'm determined, Junius, I'm determined to look into the Cuban psyche and background, because they have sat off 90 miles off the coast and told the United States to go to hell and meant it. And then turned around. Now, they have a free medical school, which is the second one I found in Latin America, because the Dominican Republic has one too, where in Cuba it's called the Latin American Health Center. You can, if you come from a third world country or a poor black community in the Western world, you can apply, and if accepted, you will get 12 years of school and medical education at no cost. And that's, and the Congressional Black Caucus is aware of this, and they haven't made a lot of noise about it, but I was just reading the first graduating class got out in 2005. And I was looking at the background information, but that school is still running. Cuba also is one of the few third world countries that's food self-sufficient. They can grow enough food in Cuba to feed the Cubans. They don't have to do no ton of importing from the West. They have nearly 100% literacy rate, Junius. And that's amazing. And so I'm saying, what was the mindset and the practical strategy that Castro used to be able to put those kind of statistics up on the board about their country when no other third world countries, and definitely the United States, have been able to achieve some of those standards? There's something going on there that other third world countries need to get with. And it's about independence of mind, mastery of the science and the chemistry and the discipline of counting and awareness, and lack of fear. You know, I ain't thinking about them. If we got to fight, then it's two to death. But in the meantime, we got to do what we need to do to be okay. And
well,
that's what they did.
Yeah, a lot of it is some of the ineptitude of the CIA and the various branches of the military that tried to overthrow him over the years. So, again, part of it is their will. Part of it is the fact that, you know, with the Cuban Missile Crisis, that they had like a big brother, the Russians, that they could run to. But the other thing, other piece is you talked about fighting. The Cubans were one of the few people that supported the Africans in Angola and in their struggle in South Africa. In fact, you'll never hear about it in any history books. You'll never probably won't read about it and won't see it on the military channel or any. It was the Cubans and the African freedom fighters that defeated the West, the Western, during a proxy war in Angola, and forced the West to surrender.
Yep. I'm fully familiar with that. And this is part of what the game is here in the States. One of the things that that Alex Jones talked about this past week was that the biochemical, biotechnical, nanotechnology scientists have begun to, they mastered the DNA process and changing the acid and structural relationships of DNA enough to begin to standardize this notion of designer drugs and biotech, in that they are now able to create vaccines and viruses that target specific cells in the body.
And not only specific cells, but specific ethnic groupings.
Well, that ethnic grouping is based on the distinguishable cellular differences between ethnicity. So that you define an ethnic group maybe by visual character, but there are also cellular differences that can be distinguished and hence can be designed for. And that's where I'm going with this. They're saying now that using the CAT scans and MRIs, they examine the brain's cellular activity under different conditions. And now they've moved to the point where they feel they've identified the portion of the brain that controls or impacts emotion, impacts spirituality. This was really something to listen to. And I understand the scientific process well enough, coupled with the ability to observe brain activity under different conditions that you manipulate or construct the experiment, that they feel they found the portion of the brain that impacts spirituality.
Yeah, but African people have known that for eons.
Well, my point is that they now have designed a designer bacteria or virus to attack the cells in that portion of the brain and destroy them. And
well,
that,
yeah,
in listening to the tape of the Pentagon training where they introduced this finding, that the cells or the virus or the bacteria can be distributed in a vaccine, aerosol spray. You know, they have a number of different delivery mechanisms. Well, one thing that comes out is that in America, in highly developed technical societies, there are no inventions that end up not getting used, Junius. If they make it, they're going to use it. The question's when, that's the only question. And so we're at the point where our technology and understanding of the human genome, the human cellular structure, allows people to experiment with a mass modification product.
Well, it's not, you know, what I call it, you know, it's a whole usurpation. If you're familiar with the notions of Ma'at and its opposite, Isfet, and the righteous people and the workers of iniquity. That's what they're doing. They're trying to attempt to usurp Ma'at, the divine order, and replace it with their own, with their sick psychopathic order.
That's right. So now I think we're down at the point, if you're familiar with Revelation scriptures, where I think there's a piece where it says demons will be released and that people will be inclined to run and hide and ask the rock for shelter, and there ain't no hiding place. And that at some point, if you're not already in the spirit and convicted, you're going to have a lot of problems. And I think we're fast approaching that time and place, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, but you also have, the organisms, and then you have the mechanical thing. I think we're being set up with the mechanical thing with the media. Notice how most of, if you were to analyze and just say a spectrum of 200 channels, what you find, and a lot of it is gratuitous violence, misdirected sexual orientation in terms of a wasting of the sexual energy or the perverting of the sexual energy, foolishness, and this whole preponderance of the belief in what I call the despiritization and desecration of humanity, where they want us to be unmindful or totally ignorant of our spiritual essence.
That's right.
And so it makes it easier to bring on the other things. I mean, we are pretty much close to using a biblical analogy of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, that's how, when you look at the public policy of this country and you listen to the Republicans, I mean, it's craziness personified. And it makes somebody like Obama, who is a minion of the very people you spoke about earlier,
yeah,
he becomes reasonable, even though he's a world-class warmonger who has set himself over and beyond that, the warmongering and the killing and the depravity of somebody like George Bush.
George Bush.
That's the kind of mentality that, I mean, they're going to make Goebbels and Hitler and those people look like choir boys.
Look like chumps. That's exactly right. And the core that Jones was pointing to is that when you have a drug that can go to the brain center and destroy theoretically the cells that the scientists say deal with spirituality, he backed up. He said, you know, they're talking about the center of the brain that they identify as related to terrorists, to jihadis, to anybody who can be so convicted that they would defy death in pursuit of an ideal. And that by destroying that center, you create a mass of people who are basically going to do what you tell them to do. They won't be convicted on anything. And they certainly wouldn't think of fighting about something unto death. They wouldn't do that anymore, as far as the scientists could figure out. So,
well, but the one thing that they see, the problem for them and the salvation for us, if we can grasp it, is that they're so materialistic. They think that everything is on the material plane. They don't understand the vital life force. They don't understand the God force.
That's right.
These cells are just manifestations of that, and the God force itself is intelligent. And it will be, what I see happening is, remember the movie Avatar?
Yeah.
At the end where the spirit took the side of the indigenous people against the earthlings.
Yeah.
That's, if you look around what's happening in nature now, because the earth is a living organism, as opposed to, from an African perspective, it's a living organism endowed and imbued with this intelligent energy spirit that the Europeans are in denial that exists.
Yeah.
That's what's going to be our salvation, if we keep ignoring the spirit and divine intelligence within ourselves. It's going to be left to that part to bring about the restoration of balance to put these crazy people in check.
Sure. And also you have to put it in terms of eternal time, that the our notion of time is distorted.
Right.
And impatient. And also the fear of death, which in my upbringing as a child, I was always told, you just go to sleep. That's all that's what dying's about. And, you know, you get on and you read other things. I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which the Bardal, and that lays it out differently. And so as you begin to inform yourself about the possible ways of looking at apparently distasteful or troublesome outcomes, it's the power of your ability to become, once again, critical thinkers and inform yourself. Your intellect is not just there. It's like a key that you have to learn to use to generate your salvation. It's a powerful tool. And if you don't learn to use it, then you keep yourself subjected to the emotional fears of apparent danger. I guess that's a way to put it.
But that's how they're manipulating the people in this country. That's what the Bush was. Every time that these terror alerts, these color-coded terror alerts, and now here in the the Obama administration, it's all this it's Iran, it's Syria. We got they're gonna homegrown terrorists. It's designed to keep people off balance, to keep them in a state of fear, so they can be manipulated.
That's right. And so your listeners and the people who are fortunate enough to have internet radio and that kind of thing, you won't hear dialogue like we've had on the broader public media. And just raising the questions, raising the issues, hopefully we can spur more people to take a critical look, to read more, debate more, reach out and talk to people across broad spheres now that on this internet, worldwide is nothing, Junius. I got people on my Facebook page from around the world. And with Google Translate, they can write in their language, you translate it, and then write back what you want to say in your language, and it translates it to their language, and you post it in the box. So the doors are opening to literature that we don't read in this country. I think about the people, and in Western science, in the last decade, there's been an acknowledgement that Western science is a child of Eastern science, that all of our foundational technology didn't come from the West, it came from the East. So now, can you imagine what the writings of the Arabic Persian people were about that we never read? And that slowly but surely, access to that information is becoming available, especially to the critical thinkers who learn how to use the technology, learn where the sources of the information are, and learn how to use the translation tools, which now have become automated. So I think we in the West, who are really hunting to understand, we're about to get a big break here. We're about to learn a whole lot of new stuff.
But the key to it is, the key to one of the elements within the Eastern philosophy is meditation.
Yep.
And basically that's the key. You don't really need a lot of outside sources. Everything that we have is within us, within our own being. And so that offers a lot of potential for liberation, personal liberation and actualization. But it also, because these people are psychopaths, and you mentioned charting brain waves, and when you look at the scans of known psychopaths and sociopaths,
right,
they do tell certain things. They do reveal certain things. And so while we're on the cusp of major enlightenment, we're also on the cusp of major psychopathy, where these crazy people could care less if they take the world down the hole, because one of their goals is to depopulate it of about 5 or 6 billion people.
That's true. That's true. But ultimately, we have to choose. We could choose, theoretically, to stay ignorant and dumb and let every day be a surprise in an uninformed manner. Or we can choose to ask questions of our spirit and look at the answers that come in. So people like us, I would think, have made a choice to ask the questions of the spirit. You could try to stop asking those questions. But I think at this point, we're convicted. We're going to ask, and we're going to look and accept the answers we get. we're on that track. We're on that path. We find ourselves in that position in this world at this point in our lives. And the key, I think, is, or for me as an inverted teacher, is to say to people who would seek a knowledge or an understanding, here's a way that you might access.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing what I'm here to do. This is where I found myself repeatedly in my life from a little kid. So I can see that now. And I guess I'm at the point where I'm saying, well, if this was what I was supposed to do, and I've looked at it in my family past, my grandfather, my mother's father, got out of Ruffin Academy in 1902, juniors, which was a normal school where they let black people go to college. Down in Tappahannock, Virginia. And, you know, you kind of say, well, this is the framework that I came up in. I mean, when I didn't know myself, the people around me were living out of that kind of reality.
Mm-hmm.
So when I finally came into knowing myself, which in the studies of child development is like you're 4 or 5 years old, I mean, it tickles me. They even say there's a period where you actually learn the difference between you and a table leg. All prior to that, all the world's the same. So it lets me know how impressionable and helpless you are in determining the foundation of your being. That's your parents and the environment you're in. And when you actually study child development, your brain is developing, and your capacity to learn is developing, and your awareness of yourself in the world and the world around you is not in your control. And so you really have to acknowledge the powers that be that are bigger than you, that ultimately let you be where you are right now having this conversation with me. I get humbled by it. I mean, I really get humbled by it. And so if that's the case for all humans on the planet, man, it's like people who end up in our situation, in our conversations, you go look at the background. What were the chance events that played in their life before they could keep themselves? And I'm talking 3-4 years old before they even were aware of themselves as an entity, separate from the dog, the cat, the chair, the Venetian blinds, or anything else, before you had consciousness of yourself as you. Well, science and different academic areas take you all through how that works and how it evolves. And once you come to grips with it, it's like, wow, I don't know how I made it through. And then that's when you start looking back at your parents and the environment that they provided for you. And then who taught them and what was their environment. And pretty soon you come to the conclusion that your trajectory into life has a whole lot of prior points to it that go past your lifetime, your parents' lifetime. You begin to see the trajectory. And it puts a different picture on things. It really does. And I think that our people, through that damn slavery trip, lost or had more barriers put between them and understanding that trajectory than other people did. As simple as that.
Yeah, well, that it was important for that whole process, what I call the desecration, meaning taking away our sacredness, as well as the dehumanization to try to turn us into beasts of burden, that we are, this is the trauma that we're trying to recover from today as we speak. And the fact that we understand that there is a energy, a spirit, an intelligence that permeates us and that can facilitate this healing, the better off we'll be, and that's why the ruling elites want to keep us from that knowledge and that understanding at all costs.
And that's where, in today's environment, Junius, there's never been a better time for people to finally get out of that lethargy and laziness and go ahead and get into reading and checking, because it is so easy to do now in terms of the mechanics of it. If they don't have the will for it, or they aren't motivated by the spirit of knowledge, then they're going to have problems. It is no question.
Well, but I would also encourage them to go within and learn to discern the spirit within, and because that takes precedence over all the other things. The other things will reinforce what the spirit within tells you. That still small voice will tell you. Because I see it in my writing a lot. I'll get an idea and write on it, and then a day later or a couple of hours later, I'll see a manifestation somewhere else that validates what I was given, sometimes through research, but sometimes just through being quiet and allowing myself to be a channel or a conduit for this to come out, and then it will validate it, and it's almost like, see, trust me, and don't worry about it.
Junius, I cannot holler amen loud enough on that wonderful description. I've learned to put it in terms of something comes to me, comes to mind, out of the blue and unbidden. I wasn't trying to think it up. It came and found me and became such a thought in my mind that it was clear in my mind. And then that confirming experience that made that unbidden thought all of a sudden take on a meaning, where the experience is in your external reality.
Mm-hmm.
The interior thought that comes to you, to mind, is in your internal side.
Right, right.
And the spirit sends that to you and then positions you to validate its meaning in the external material world. I have been through that. That is a way of living for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it starts with the willingness to pray, to talk to the spirit, your father, whatever you want, in your closet, by yourself. And what I have found that floors me, that in its simplicity, it is no more than to ask for it. Just ask. Be clear. Say what you mean. Say what's troubling you. And ask for what you want in words, just like you were talking to anybody else. And Junior, it delivers.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
And that's the message that, you know, we need to push out there, because this culture, particularly with the consumerism, and the consumerism is tied to materialism and hedonism and the desecration, and meaning the taking away of our sacredness. We need to push forward that message that we've been talking about, that shared experience that we both have. It's not just for artists. It's not just for writers. It's everybody.
Everybody's got it. Everybody. And it's as simple as asking. That's what I sometimes tickle myself when I think about the troubles or things I would call problematic. And I didn't have sense enough to defocus on that and turn inside and just ask.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have a discussion and ask for guidance, ask for relief. As simple as that. And it's gotten to be, as I've gotten older, my patience has gotten better. And I back up off of things and see them coming a lot sooner. And say, if this is what I've got to face, then help me or explain to me. And I do that. And sure enough, life has gotten better and better and better. And yeah. As I participate in Facebook, one of the things I participate in is it's a barometer of the thoughts that people are willing to put in a public meeting. And the broader the social or demographics that you have in there, the bigger picture you get to see of what is on the minds of people in that demographic or range that you've set up on your computer. And I, you know, I look at it and I see what the young folks are talking about. I see what the fledgling members of the upper class are talking about, the Europeans, the black folks. And it kind of is just an information channel that feeds in all the other, feeds into me as all the other information on the internet does. And my head, that thing in the back of my head and my spirit cogitates it, it turns, and it's just another database that my spirit can pick from to send me information and understanding. I guess that's a way, a good way for me to express how I frame Facebook and this social media, to tell you the truth.
Speaking of social media, how can people see your work, your photography? How can people contact you and to exchange ideas? Because for me, these things, yeah, while they're big brother, they're also a means for consciousness, to share consciousness and raise consciousness, although I'm not into it as the penultimate of tools to do that. Again, my, from my perspective, is introspection and meditation. But
right.
But we need to use these tools to link up with people of like mind and like consciousness. So how can people get a hold of you?
Okay, I got a couple of channels. First of all, I'm on Facebook, Emery Graham. That's the easiest. EmeryGraham. I only think there's one out there. Then I have a website, my business website, and that's practiceinc.weebly.com. And that website has links to my other websites, phone number, email address, which is greatshot5, all together, at verizon.net. And with those three items, you can get to me anytime.
Any projects you're getting ready to embark on, or anything that you're doing, that you're working on in terms of photojournalism, that you might want to share with the listeners before we let you go?
Yes. One of the products in my main photography product when I do commercial or business is a book, a coffee table book of images. So that's what my product is when I shoot weddings or events, you know, the different banquets or award ceremonies, is I put out an 11 by 13 colorful covered book full of the pictures of the event. Well, I'm thinking about doing a joint product in the Dominican baseball piece with another writer named Charles Farrell, who's a graduate of Northwestern School of Journalism and a former newspaper reporter for a couple of papers in the country in the Chronicles of Higher Ed, to shoot the pictures, have him do the narrative, and then begin to issue a series of these hardback books to drive awareness around sports, oppression, domination, and the way out. So I'm taking a look at that as a potential direction to go with the photography, economic development, and journalism.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any closing thoughts you want to share before we let you go?
No, I've just about thought out, and I just wish all the readership would consider taking up, all of your listenership would consider taking up the challenge of critical thinking and learn to use Wikipedia and Google to get definitions for things you don't understand, and then listen to the Spirit and go at it. The Spirit will guide you through this. I appreciate the opportunity and always enjoy the conversation with you, Junior.
Hey, man, my pleasure. It's good to know that there are brothers out there who have not been dumbed down and have not bought into the notion that you have to be stupid, not being that, I don't mean unintelligent, but I mean in a stupor from where it comes from.
Mindlessness.
Yeah. So, brother, stay strong.
You too, James. Be good.
All right, man.
Cyberspace is a place that no army with artillery invades. Where no military.
You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We invite you to tune in again and engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind, the rest will follow.
That no corporation incorporates, no denomination faith dominates, and no court is going to try.